It was a big petition. Edyard had to back up the initial street association meetings personally, persuading the stallholders and shopkeepers and tavern owners and merchants and a dozen other tradespeople that his idea was worth trying. With his small base of political allies like Setursis, Ronark and Finneton, and his own reputation, he began to gain the backing he needed. A week after the meeting with Salarin, the Jeevan's Chamber of Trade and the Silvarum Chamber of Trade simultaneously laid down a formal request to see their respective district masters and representatives. They convened in the library of District Master Vologral's mansion. Edyard had only met the Jeevan's master twice before, at formal events. There, they'd made small talk, trying to weigh each other up. He was heartened by the fact that Vologral was an ally of Finneton on the Grand Council. Vologral and the other three masters stood behind a long table, listening to the official request as made by the speakers of the Chambers of Trade. Then he turned to Edyard. "Can this work?"
"I believe so, sir," Edyard said. "We know probably 7 out of 10 involved in the protection rackets, certainly in our districts. Those are the ones we already have warrants for. If the gangs send in new faces to collect their money, we'll know who they are straight away, and we can add them to the list."
"But keeping them out?" Vologral looked apprehensive.
"In total, there are 15 bridges into the two districts. Each one will have a pair of constables on duty from now on to enforce the exclusion. We just need the legal basis."
"And the mooring platforms? How many of them? You can't guard them all."
"There will be 3 permanent patrols inspecting the mooring platforms at random. In addition, our G-Eagles will be scouting constantly. I'd point out that a court can levy a considerable fine to any gondolier who violates a city bylaw. We'll need to make an example of the first few cases, possibly with confiscation of their craft. After that, they won't be so keen to help the gangs."
"I can imagine the Gondolier Guild's reaction to that," Deveron, the Silvarum representative, muttered.
"The Water Walker is making an effort to help us," Setursis said quietly. "I, for one, am happy to cooperate."
Deveron looked at him and said no more.
"Very well," Vologral said. "I am provisionally inclined to grant your petition. I will sign the warrants. However, I give you notice, Water Walker, that I will review the situation in 3 weeks' time, after the Festival of Guidance. If I am not satisfied that racketeering has subsided, or you are not holding the line against the gangs, they will be revoked. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir."
"Do you have the warrants here?"
Edyard beckoned Felax and the other 3 probationary constables who were waiting at the back of the delegation. Each of them came forward carrying a tall stack of paper.
"Great lady!"
Vologral grunted when he saw how many warrants the young constables had brought. "I didn't know I was excluding half the city."
73 people to start with, sir," Edyard said.
"Gentlemen," Vologral said to his fellow masters, "let's hope we don't get writer's cramp."
He sat down at the long table.
"What happens to the rest of the city?" Deveron asked. "Aren't we just exporting the problem?"
"They'll wait to see if it works," Setursis said. "If it does, they'll join in quickly enough. Decent people have had enough."
Vologral signed the first warrant.
"So suppose you do succeed. Exclude them from everywhere but Sampaloc, for I know damn well that Bice will never sign one of these. What then?"
"I imagine that will be up to the Grand Council, sir."
"Ha!"
Vologral gave Edyard a sly smile of approval as he reached for another warrant. "Not such a country boy after all, eh?"
It began the very next morning. Ronark changed the squad shifts, which in itself was fairly historic, dispatching 5 constables to each of the bridges leading into Jeevan's from Droop, Tycho, and Majate. Silvarum station captain did the same with bridges to Haxpen and Padua. As dawn broke, the constables took up position. News of the exclusion had spread in that lightning-fast way any novelty did in Macathran, especially one concerning the Water Walker. A lot of people turned up to see if it was actually going to happen. At some bridges they applauded when the constables appeared. Sandwiches and hot tea and coffee were produced and offered to the new guard squads. Then everyone settled down to see what the gangs would do. At midday, 8 men walked across Golden Park. They were young and tough, knew how to handle themselves in a fight, and had a strong third hand. By the time they reached the district's southern point adjoining Birmingham Pool, there were 5 G-Eagles orbiting high above them, only 2 of which belonged to the constables. "Getting a real burst of nostalgia here," Maxon sang out as Edyard's squad jogged along Macoun Street. "Nostalgia is a happy sensation," Cansine grunted. "This isn't." Edyard tended to agree with her. He glanced at Isowix's bakery as they sped past. "You all right?" he asked Dinlay with a direct long-talk whisper. "Oh, Lady Yay!" Dinlay's thoughts were aflame with expectation. They'd spent the morning walking round the 2 districts on a random route, making themselves visible, knowing there would be a showdown at some time. It should have been a time of high excitement for Edyard, but he'd got another letter from Salrana. She'd been delayed again. He ran out of Macoun Street onto the broad sweep of the Alameda. The weeping Hasfold trees were just budding, a multitude of blue and yellow striped leaves expanding out of their walls to greet the warmer skies. Right ahead of them was the blue and silver bridge which looped high over the waters of the great major canal to Golden Park. Sergeant Che was standing at the foot of it, giving Edyard's slightly out-of-breath squad a nonchalant look. "I'm insulted," he said loftily. "You don't trust me?"
"Procedure, sir," Maxon puffed. "We're the reinforcements, sir."
"But I haven't called for you yet." Edyard gestured at the bridge. "All yours, sir." "Thank you." Che glanced round at the eager crowd that was building. "This is nostalgic, eh?" He turned and led the 4 constables of his squad up onto the bridge. "Have any of them got guns?" Boyd asked.
"I can't sense any," Cansine said. "Edyard?"
"No, nothing. Ival will want it to appear like they're just ordinary citizens. He needs to make us the bad guys."
"Hey, Water Walker!" a young boy yelled out cheekily. "Are you going to do it again?"
"Not today."
"Oh, go on, please. Run over the pool. I didn't see it before."
The 8 men had reached the other end of the bridge. Che and his squad were standing on the apex, arms folded, waiting patiently. "This is a different day," Edyard said out loud. The crowd were dividing their attention between him and the gang members over on Golden Park. "This day we banish the gangs from your streets and lives." The gangmen stepped onto the bridge.
"Yo," Che bellowed. "Pocklin, we know you and your friends. Come no further."
The 8 men kept walking forward.
"I have a warrant signed by the District Master of Jeevans excluding you from this district."
"I have done nothing wrong," Pocklin shouted back. "I am a free man. I may go where I please in this city. That is the law."
"Halt and turn around. Go back where you scum came from."
Boyd nudged Edyard.
"Look who's here," he growled.
Edyard glanced over where Boyd indicated. Master Cheriks was standing at the front of the crowd, watching intently.
"We knew they'd try to quash the warrants in the courts," Dinlay said.
"Please don't let this come down to lawyers," Cansine moaned.
"I'm visiting my mother who lives in Jeevans," Pocklin said, appealing reasonably to the silent, spellbound crowd. "She has only a few days to live. Would you deny me that right?"
"What a load of bollocks," Dinlay said under his breath.
"Piss off," Che said, jabbing his finger forcefully back down the bridge. "Now."
"Sergeant," Master Cherick said. It wasn't a particularly loud voice, but the authority behind it carried a long way.
Che turned round, an expression of utter disgust on his face, backed up by some very strong thoughts escaping past his shield.
"Yes, sir."
"I am this fine gentleman's legal counsel. May I see the so-called exclusion warrant, please?"
"It's back at the station."
"Then until you produce it and let him see it, as is his right, my client is free to go about his business in whatever district of this city he chooses, as do his equally innocent colleagues."
"All right, then," Che said and jabbed his finger at Pocklin again. "Wait here. I'll send a runner."
"No, Sergeant," Cherick said. "You cannot detain my client without just cause.
It is your responsibility to bring the warrant to him. Until it is read to him, he is free to go as he pleases.
I can't run around the district after him and the others, Chase said.
That is not my client's problem, Master Cherrick said affably.
Buckland's smirk was indecent. Step aside, he told Che. Edyard walked forward.
Master Cherrick's.
Corporal Edyard, how nice to see you. I believe you can be of some help in this unfortunate matter. Your colleague here was about to act unlawfully. As a constable of this city, I am asking you to see the law is enforced equally and fairly.
My pleasure.
Master Cherrick's beckoned Pockland.
Come on across the bridge now, please, my dear chap. You are quite safe with the water walker himself, guaranteeing your legal rights.
Were you referring to a warrant like this? Edyard asked innocently. He pulled a roll of parchment out of his tunic. Master Cherrick's unctuous smile flattened as he started to read.
But this warrant names...
You, Edyard smiled.
Yes, and as such I am required, by law, to assist you out of Jeevan's as quickly as possible.
He reached out with his third hand. Master Cherrick's yelled in consternation as his feet left the ground. The cry turned to pure panic as he kept on rising. The crowd on the Alameda gasped as the lawyer soared away over the bridge, continuing to gain height.
Put me down! Cherrick screamed with his voice and long talk.
He was higher than the buildings behind the Alameda, higher than the white metal pillars lining Golden Park, still ascending. The watching G-Eagles had to curve sharply to avoid him.
Did you hear something? Edyard asked.
He told you to put him down, Cansine pronounced solemnly.
Oh, fair enough, Edyard said.
He let go. Cherrick fell out of the sky with an incoherent shriek of fright. He landed in the middle of Birmingham Pool, producing a tremendous splash. The crowd cheered wildly.
Che turned back to Pucklin.
Now where were we? Pucklin gave the sergeant a furious look, then glanced over his shoulder to where an impassive Edyard was waiting. He turned and led his companions back into Golden Park.
Maxon put his arm round Edyard's shoulder, squeezing strongly.
Now why is it, do you suppose, people you don't like always wind up getting dunked in Birmingham Pool?
Nostalgia.
Edyard had been looking forward to the ladies' festival of guidance for what seemed like most of the winter. His friends, and the girls he'd encountered, were always speaking of it in enthusiastic tones. Firstly, it signaled the onset of summer, which, as far as he was concerned, couldn't arrive fast enough. But the main reason was to celebrate those who had passed away in the previous year. Everybody who had lost someone made a small memorial boat out of flowers, of any and every color except white. Mainly it was the children of a family who made them, producing elaborate and colorful boats up to a yard long. They represented the soul of the departed one. At midday, the Pythia conducted a service of memorial in the ladies' church in Erie. When that ended, all the flower boats would be placed in the city's canals. The gondoliers, bedecked in white flowers, guided them down to the port, singing hymns of commemoration. Gondolas represented the Sky Lords, who the lady promised would come to Quirentia once again to guide the souls of humans into the welcome embrace of Odin's sea. At the port, the gondolas would stop, and the flower boats would carry on, drifting out across the waves. It sounded delightful. Especially the evening, which was one giant party. Now the day was here, and Edyard dozed fitfully as the dawn came to a clear sky, promising good weather for the festival. Chief Constable Walsfold's long talk intruded sharply into his thoughts.
Sir?
He responded groggily as the dregs of yet another bizarre dream drained away. He hadn't known the man had such a powerful long talk. It made sense, though. After Ranelagh, a lot of things about the city hierarchy were clearer to him.
"I need you to report to the Culverit family mansion in Haxpen," Walsfold told him. "Come at once."
"Yes, sir," Edyard said sleepily. "Why?"
"I will meet you there and explain the situation. You'd better bring the rest of your squad, too."
Edyard rubbed his eyes. He hadn't got to bed until well after midnight.
Late last evening, the Lilylight Street Association had spotted a gondola with three known gang members making their way along Victoria Canal. Ediard and a couple of Silvarum constables had intercepted them at a mooring platform on Flight Canal. No resistance had been offered when the men were told to leave, but he'd still kept watch on the gondola as it made its way back down the great major canal. That was the way of his days now, constantly alert for attempts to infiltrate racketeers into Jeevans and Silvarum, called to shops and other businesses when unknown gang members did get through. 2 days wasted in court on charges of aggravated psychic assault filed by Master Cherix, who, thankfully, in law, was no match for Master Solarin. He groaned and pushed his feet out from under the nice warm sheets. Jessal shifted round on the springy mattress.
"What?" she mumbled. "Have to go," he said softly and kissed her forehead.
She moaned again and curled up tighter.
"I won't be here tonight. Have to be with family for the party. See you tomorrow."
"Right." But she was already asleep again. He ordered a G-chimp to bring a fresh set of clothes. While he was struggling into them in the dim light, he started to call the others. It was rather satisfying, spreading the misery. Ediard pulled his boots on beside the door and gave his own flower boat a wistful glance. It wasn't much, a simple frame of card a foot long, over which he'd stuck a dozen red and yellow roses. His friend assured him it was just right, exactly what everyone else constructed. For him it was a belated memorial to Akim and all the others of Ashwell Village. He met up with Boyd and Cansine on the tenement walkway outside. They weren't in the best of moods at being hauled from their beds so early. Ediard couldn't bring himself to look at Cansine. She hadn't been alone. "Are we waiting for Denley?" Boyd asked as they made their way down the stairs.
"He'll join us there."
A smile spread across Boyd's face.
"You mean he was with someone?"
"Not our concern," Ediard said, a fraction too sharply. Now he really couldn't look at Cansine.
"Any idea what this is about?" she asked.
"None. But if we're being summoned to the Culverit family by Walsfoal himself on this day, you can bet it isn't going to be trivial."
"Julin is the Haxbend district master," Boyd said. "He's one of the waverers, isn't he?"
"I think so," Ediard said, rubbing his hand over his brow. In truth, he'd lost track of which master was for them. Their allegiances were very fluid. Lately, he'd given up trying to follow the Grand Council machinations and just prayed Finnerton would prevail tomorrow. Boyd opened the big wrought iron gate at the entrance to the tenement. Maxon was waiting outside. He raised an arm in greeting.
"Denley's still not over Kyron, you know," Boyd said cheerfully.
"We all got a nasty shock over Ivar's methods," Ediard told him as they went out into the street. "Let's just forget about that and move on, shall we?" Boyd was clearly going to make some other snide comment. He'd even started to open his mouth when a voice cut across the empty street.
"Water Walker!"
a woman cried. She had been sitting up in the doorway of a tailor's shop opposite the tenement. Ediard's farsight had sensed her as they were on the last flight of stairs, but she hadn't been carrying any weapons. She did have three children with her, which was mildly unusual at this time of day, but not anything to concern himself over. He'd assumed she was simply bright and early for the festival. Now she came striding across the street, pulling the sleepy, miserable children with her. The eldest was no more than 5, while the youngest, a girl, was barely old enough to walk.
"Where do I go, Water Walker?" she demanded belligerently. "Tell me that, eh? Where?"
"What?" Ediard asked, very confused. Maxen was hurrying over to them.
"How will my children eat? Ask him, Daniel. Go on. Ask the great Water Walker where your next meal is coming from."
The middle child, a boy in a ragged green pullover and worn grey trousers, was thrust forward. He looked up at Ediard and his lip began to quake. He burst into tears.
"I want me da,"
he wailed.
"What?"
Ediard asked again.
"Edis, my husband," the woman barked. "You exiled him, threw him out of his own house. We live in Fonscale Street. Now you bastards come along and tell him he's banned from Silvarum, where we've lived for 7 years. He can't come home, can't come to the house my family has lived in for 3 centuries. What kind of a law is that, eh? So you tell me, where do I go? How do I feed the children without their father, eh?" Answer me, you backward country shite!
Ediard just stared at her, his mind a shocked blank. Boyd groaned and rolled his eyes up, appealing to the lady.
Oh, crap it, he groaned.
Cansine was having none of it.
How did he feed them before? She asked. What job did your husband have?
Go to Honius, bitch! You've done this to us, you've ruined our lives.
What job?
He's a good man, he put food on the table for us, he loved his kiddies.
Yours, maybe, Cansine said.
But he hurt other children, didn't he? Threatened them, hit them, made their parents hand over money they'd worked hard for.
He never did.
She covered the eldest boy's ears.
Lies, that's what you speak, lies. You'll all go to Honius. Edis worked in the abattoir on Crompton Alley. Dirty work, hard work that no genistar can do.
You knew what he did, Cansine snarled. If you miss him, then go to him, follow him to his new home. But remember this, we will wipe the city clean of his kind. After this year, there'll be no more of him.
The woman spat at Cansine, who swatted it away with her third hand. All three children were crying now.
I want you to tell Edis something from me, Ediard said. Tell him that if he leaves the gang behind, if he finds himself a proper job, and there's plenty to be had, he'll be welcome back in Fonscale Street. I'll cancel the warrant myself. That's all he's got to do.
Screw you! She pulled at her children. You know nothing about life. Ivar will dance on your ashes yet, and no Sky Lord will ever rescue your soul.
Maxon touched the rim of his hat as she stomped off down the street. Thank you, madam. Always a pleasure to help the citizenry. But he didn't say it very loud.
You okay?
Cansine asked.
Yeah.
Ediard gave her a shaky nod.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Lady, how many families have been split up like that?
Are you serious?
An incredulous Cansine asked. What about the families of Edis's victims? The people you're supposed to be helping? Isoix and his children? Don't they deserve some consideration?
Yes, sorry.
He hung his head. I just wasn't expecting this to be so hard.
Cheer up, Boyd said and put his arm round Ediard. It can only get worse.
Ediard was about to remonstrate, then saw Boyd's mocking expression, and he managed a weak smile.
Much worse.
Far, far worse, Maxon promised. Let's go and see what misery and torment Walsfoal has in store for us, then. As he set off with his friends, Ediard chastised himself for not expecting such an ambush. The only real surprise was that it hadn't happened earlier. Although they'd managed to add another 50 warrants to the original batch, 15 had been cancelled. There had been a few genuine cases of mistaken identity, but more than one person in the associations had used the scheme to settle an old grudge. Then there were some traders who'd taken advantage in order to get commercial rivals banned from the district, reducing competition. Each reported case of abuse had to be properly reviewed and sorted out, which took a great deal of time for the constables, but not as long as a court case, as Ediard had to keep pointing out to the grumbling masters and station captains. But even with the troubles and abuse and legal challenges and the racketeers' unrelenting attempts to get past, he considered it a success. And in that he wasn't alone. The gangs had made hardly any collections in Jeevans and Silvarum, and only two traders had been assaulted before the constables arrived. Macathran's remaining districts had watched the results keenly. Under continuing pressure, the masters of Haxpen, Lilylight, Droop, Ilongo, and Padua were drawing up their own warrants and talking to the station captains about enforcement. In another couple of days, they could well be signed. Tomorrow was the last day of Volagral's three-week trial. Not that the district master and representatives would have the final say. Not anymore. The Grand Council was due to convene to debate the disturbance to city life caused by the reintroduction of the exclusion warrants. Finnerton was leading the block of councillors arguing their benefit. If they lost, the warrants would be revoked, and as Finnerton had told him, Bice was preparing an act to rescind the original law. He had a lot of tacit support, Finnerton said, because no one was sure where the whole thing would end. Was it the Water Walker's intention to turn Sampaloc into a criminal ghetto, cut off from the rest of the city?
And exactly how did such a young, inexperienced constable come to lead such a campaign in the first place? Politically, the masters were becoming very nervous of Ediard. Finnerton was coming under increasing pressure from his fellow masters to produce a valid conclusion to the campaign. Ediard didn't actually have one. When he did think that far ahead, to a time every district had issued warrants, he'd assumed the Grand Council would step in with a final solution. Expulsion was his preferred option, though he wasn't sure how that would be achieved, nor where the gang members would be banished to. He'd just wanted to start the ball rolling, to give people hope. Only now were the true consequences becoming apparent. Though even he had to laugh when, on the day after Cherix received his ducking in Birmingham Pool, District Master Bice very publicly signed an exclusion warrant, preventing Ediard from entering Sampaloc. Less amusing was the dignified announcement from the Pythia, saying that she would never prohibit anyone from entering Erie to attend the ladies' church. Owen also declared no warrants would apply to Anemone and Majate, so that all citizens would be able to reach the seat of government, a right which Ra himself had laid down. And as for the protestations from the Gondoliers' Guild about restricting their trade, there had never been a gondola strike in Macathran before. Even though it had only lasted a day, it shocked everyone. There were threats that more would be called, especially if the vote in the Grand Council tomorrow didn't go the way the Gondoliers wanted. The Dockers Guild had also pitched in with a promise to support the Gondoliers. Thankfully, Ediard was getting a lot of support and encouragement from various traders and merchants. Ordinary people, too, were grateful, if their reaction to the constable squads on bridge duty were anything to go by. Ediard just wanted tomorrow's council debate to be over, one way or the other. The weight of expectation that had fallen on him was awesome. Dinlay was waiting outside the main entrance of the Culverit family mansion. The first rays of sunlight had already reached the highest level of the 10-story ziggurat to glint on the huge horseshoe arch windows. 5 pistol-carrying guards with the family's insignia on their coats opened the grand iron-bound front gate. The squad walked in through the giant archway to find themselves in a broad courtyard. Vivid topaz climbing roses smothered the pillars on every side, while tall granite statues of past Culverit masters and mistresses gazed down sternly. An equerry greeted them and ushered them inside. Ediard sighed when confronted with a spiral stair. "I suppose the family live on the top floor," he muttered to Boyd. "The master's family do, of course." The summit of the mansion was a house larger than the Jeevan's constable station, surrounded on each side by a strip of hortus garden. It was the traditional residence of the district master, with the lower floors occupied by dozens of relatives and household staff and clerks who administered his estates. As they ascended, Ediard became very conscious of the mood swirling round him. There was anger, predominant in the men, and a great deal of fright and sorrow. "Something bad has happened here," he said quietly. Maxon gave a short, uncomfortable nod of agreement. Walsfall and Julin were waiting for them on the upper Hortus garden that faced the Grand Major Canal. Even so early, the chief constable was wearing a pristine tunic, his gold buttons shining brightly in the rising sun. Julin, by contrast, was one of the few aristocrats who showed his age. 153 years made his shoulders sag and his grey hair thin. He wore a rumpled house robe over his nightshirt. His eyes were red-rimmed and sunken with abject despair. The squad had brought Ediard up to date with Culverit family gossip on the way over. Now, as never before, they were the subject of intense speculation and discussion within the rest of Macathran's aristocracy. Master Julin had married very late in life. In itself, that wasn't too unusual among his class. It was a truly romantic marriage. Apparently he fell completely in love with his wife, 108 years his junior, as soon as they were introduced, and was utterly devoted to her until her tragic, untimely death 6 years ago. Though what scandalized everyone was that the first child she produced had been a daughter, Christabel, as was their second child, during whose birth she'd died. There was no son to inherit. It was almost without precedent in the city, but to the dismay of Lorin, Julin's younger brother, there was a clause in the Culverit family's legally registered claim to the Haxben district to allow the lineage continuation through a daughter
if there were no sons. The situation had occurred only twice before in Macathran's 2,000-year history. Consequently, Julin was estranged from a good percentage of his relatives. Meanwhile, Christabel was the most desired girl in the city, with every noble son desperate for an introduction. Any party she was due to attend was besieged by potential suitors. And lady, wouldn't you just know it, she's an exceptionally pretty thing, too, Maxin had finished wistfully. We have a problem, Walsfoll announced as soon as the squad was ushered onto the high terrace. No doubt the entire city will know by breakfast, but Menatha has been abducted. Ediard risked a sideways glance at Dinlay.
The second daughter, Dinlay explained with direct long talk.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, Ediard said to Julin. Obviously, if I can do anything to help, I will. Julin's distress abated long enough for him to give Ediard a fierce, judgmental stare. He held up a small square of paper.
You can start by explaining this.
Ediard gave him a puzzled look and appealed to Walsfoll. The chief constable gently extracted the paper from Julin and handed it to Ediard.
A G-Eagle delivered it not quite an hour ago.
With a sinking heart, Ediard read the note.
Myrnatha is very sweet. The price of her return alive and still sweet is 8,000 gold guineas. If you agree to our price, fly a yellow and green flag from the Orchard Palace this noon. The Water Walker is to deliver our coinage by himself. He will go to Jacob's Hall Tavern in Oestorn at midnight. Further instructions will be given to him there. If anyone is with him, or if he tries to snatch her back without paying, she will be killed.
Oh, lady, no, Ediard groaned.
I can't order you to deliver the money, Walsfoll said. You don't have to, sir. I'll take it, of course.
Do you have the money?
He asked Julin. With that much coinage, you could buy Rulan province and still have enough left over for a fleet of the fastest merchant vessels.
It can be found, yes.
Where's Oestorn?
It's a village out on the Iguru, Dinlay said. Maybe 2 hours' ride from the south gate. A long way from any possible help, Ediard realized, and even I can't long talk that far. The note was delivered after Menatha was taken, he said delicately. Is there any proof that it came from those who hold her? Julin held up his hand. His fingers clenched a blue ribbon with a long tuft of gold-brown hair.
This was attached.
I understand. Tears were running down the old man's cheeks.
The ribbon was from her nightdress. I know it was. I kissed her goodnight. I kiss my Menatha every night. She is so precious.
He began to cry, sobbing helplessly. Walsfoll moved to comfort him.
We'll have her back for you, my friend, be assured. Every effort will be made. The constabulary will not rest until she is in your arms again.
She is but a child, Julin wailed. 6 years old! Who could do such a thing? Why?
He stared wildly at Ediard.
Why have they done this? What is your part in this? Why you? Why can't I go? She's my baby.
I don't know, sir.
Somehow, just having so much anguish directed at him made Ediard feel shamed.
Of course you do,
a thin voice snapped. Ediard's farsight identified her, being helped through the doorway behind him out onto the hortus, but he didn't want to turn round.
It's your fault, Mistress Florel insisted, and yours alone. You caused this with your ridiculous crusade against the gangs. Why couldn't you just leave things well alone? Nobody was being harmed. The city worked perfectly well before you arrived.
Ediard took a deep breath, trying to keep a shield around the growing anger in his mind. Mistress Florel was in one of her usual archaic black dresses, wearing a tall hat that seemed to have purple fruit growing out of it. A man in fine aristocratic robes was holding her arm as she made her way slowly towards Ediard.
Loren, Maxen murmured, Julin's younger brother.
Mistress Florel stood directly in front of Ediard,
her shoulders all hunched up as if in sorrow, but still managed to fix him with a merciless stare.
Well?
Mistress Florell,
what have you got to say for yourself?
I will bring the girl back and deal with those responsible.
You will do no such thing. You will hand the money over as you're told, nothing more. I don't want this made any worse by your wretched stupidity. Officers from the militia will take full charge of things from now on. Gentlemen of good character and family, that's what we need, not some country buffoon.
Edyard felt his teeth grinding together. Boyd put his hand on Edyard's arm, smiling politely.
We will cooperate in any way we can, Mistress Florell.
Her eyes narrowed.
I know you. Soraya has taken a shine to you.
Yes, mistress.
She dismissed him with a flutter of her hand. Her voice took on a tragic tone.
My dear, dear boy.
Her arms rose up in sympathetic greeting as she shuffled over to Julian.
How are you coping? This is all too, too terrible.
She'll come back,
Julian managed to stammer.
We'll make sure of it, brother,
Lauren said effusively. What has passed between us is nothing now. I am resolute in helping you endure this ordeal. Julian bobbed his head.
Thank you,
he whispered.
Come along, Mistress Florell said. Sit down, my dear Julian. Your family is here to comfort you now. That is what you need. You are no longer alone or surrounded by fools. Go and get him some tea,
she told Walsfoll imperiously.
Now, my boy, have you enough money to pay the ransom? I will help, if not. We simply must get her back to her home and loving family.
Walsfoll inclined his head respectfully to Julian as he left the Hortus and signaled the squad to follow. They hurried after him.
Now what?
Edyard asked. I hate to concede the point, but Mistress Florell is right in one respect, Walsfoll said. This is about you.
Yes, sir,
Edyard said miserably. Stay here for now in case they get in touch again, and for the lady's sake, keep out of her way, Walsfoll said, pointing back through the horseshoe arch in considerable irritation. I'm going to convene the station captains. Somebody out there must know where that poor girl is. One of them will talk.
Edyard was looking round the magnificent lounge with its clutter of fabulous artwork and gilded furniture.
How did they get up here? He asked in bewilderment. And then how did they get out again, carrying Manartha? In the lady's name, there are hundreds of people in the mansion, and this is the 10th floor.
A valid question, Walsfoll said in a low voice. The captain of the house guard here is called Homelt. Talk to him. The kidnappers must have had some inside help. Take a look round the girl's room. There must be some clue, some evidence we can use to uncover the kidnapper.
Do you think she's still alive, sir? Walsfoll took another guilty look out onto the pleasant Hortus.
Very few kidnapping victims are ever returned. Just enough to make the families and merchants pay out in the hope that their loved one will be the exception.
So she might still be alive.
Yes, she might. We have to carry on in the belief that Manartha is going to be handed over safe and well in return for the money.
Edyard wasn't much encouraged by his tone. They found Homelt waiting for them in the central corridor. He was in his 50s, thick-set but still fit. The kidnapping had left him angry and distressed. It was taking up a lot of self-control just to clamp down on his emotions. He'd spent 20 years in the constables, he told them, serving out of Belis Station.
I was a good constable, he insisted. Not like some of them, who were just in it for the payoff. I did my duty and earned this post.
So how did they get her? Edyard asked.
For an instant it looked like Homelt might strike out. He stood quite still and took a long breath.
I don't know. And that's the lady's honest truth. It was the middle of the night. All our gates are locked and guarded. There are more guards on random patrol inside. There's always someone on the stairs. I just don't understand.
What about new guards?
Yesterday I thought I could trust every one of them. Today I'm not sure of anything anymore. We don't take in just anyone. They have to be known and sponsored. And like you, we've got a pretty good idea who's in with the gangs.
All right. So tell us what happened.
The kid's nursery maid raised the alarm really early on. The first thing we did was double the gate guards. Then we searched the whole mansion, every room, I promise you. Not just far sight, we physically inspected everywhere. Then that bloody G-Eagle flapped down onto the 10th floor hortus. The master, I've never seen him so broken. She was a lovely little thing, she really was. Nothing like you'd expect a family child. None of the heirs half of them have.
Can I see the room, please?
What do you think? Dinlay asked as Homelt led them along the corridors. Dispirited staff hung their heads as the squad walked past. Ediard couldn't detect the faintest flash of guilt. They all shared the same numb horror. The three nursery maids were in their parlour next to the family rooms, all weeping openly. Even the G-monkeys were subdued, caught up in the emotions saturating the mansion.
The same as you, Ediard said.
Somebody with a concealment ability. There's no other way.
The gangs have that, Cancine asked in alarm.
Not the street soldiers we normally deal with, but I found out the hard way that Ivarl has a considerable psychic power. Manartha's nursery room was the same size as the whole of Ediard's maisonette. The walls were draped in pink tapestries depicting colourful fairies and Nika sprites and birds. Dressers and chairs were lined in streamers of fluffy pink feathers. There were two big dolls' houses whose elaborately dressed inhabitants were strewn everywhere. A wooden rocking horse stood in one corner. The wardrobes were full of sweet little frocks. Ediard found it painful just standing on the pink carpet looking round. He sniffed the air. Do you smell that? Something tangy. Walking round, the smell was strongest by the bed with its tweed lace canopy.
Chloroform, Homelt said. That's how they kept her quiet.
What's chloroform? Ediard asked. The squad was regarding him with an expression he was starting to tire of.
It's a chemical, Dinlay said. If it's inhaled, it puts you to sleep. Nearly every kidnapper uses it. You soak it into a cloth and hold it over your victim's face.
Chemicals, Ediard said. They used chemicals on a 6-year-old girl.
Yes,
Homelt was giving him a strange look. Ediard took a final look round the nursery and pushed the glass doors open. The section of the hortus directly outside was mainly laid with grass, with some ornate yew trees in urns standing along the silvery-grey balustrade. He stood with his hands pressing down on the rail and looked down. Each of the terraces in the ziggurat was laid out below him, forming a series of horticultural steps down to the ground. Now spring had truly arrived. The plants formed a blaze of colour as their flowers opened to greet the warm days. Menatha's hortus faced east. Away to his left, the great major canal stretched out in a perfectly straight line to the Lyot Sea in the distance. People were just starting to appear along its side, claiming their position in readiness for the festival. He let his farsight expand along it, past Forest Pool and Midpool, down to First Pool, which formed the base of Myco. There was the House of Blue Petals, its interior impressively restored after the fire. Ivarl stood in front of his office's oval window, stretching his far sight towards Ediard. Just for a second, Ediard was back in his room at the Ashwell Eggshaper Guild, searching the towers of the village gate for any sign of the guards, with the bandit chief watching him.
I wouldn't have believed even you would stoop to this, Ediard informed his adversary coldly. She's 6 years old for the lady's sake. 6!
I'm sorry about the girl, Ivarl replied. But it wasn't me.
You're a bad liar.
You and your activities have started to dismay some very important people in this city. And that stunt you pulled vanishing in the fire, that was impressive, even to me. They're starting to work out what you are, and what you're capable of. I have a feeling myself that even you don't know your full potential yet. Not that it matters, because that potential has already made them fearful. You won't be allowed to reach it. They'll make sure of that. That's what today is about. Not the girl. She's just a means to an end. But you know that already, don't you?
Where is she?
I don't know. Nor do I know who does. If you want her, you'll have to deliver the ransom.
Is she still alive?
I would imagine so. They need to entice you out of the city by yourself, away from any possible help. If she's dead,
They lose their advantage and their ability to manipulate you. Just an observation. From someone who has a lot more experience than you in such matters.
Who has done this?
Oh, please, Waterwalker.
I hold you responsible.
Really? Is the truth too great a burden for you? This is your war, and you should have considered the consequences before you began it. It's far too late now to act outraged when it goes against you. And you can't back out now. You're the only one who can save her.
Will you negotiate for me? I'll go to them in Oerstorn, if they let her go.
You really are that stupidly noble, aren't you? Dear lady, youth and its virtue. This city will be doomed if you ever sit in the mayor's chair at council.
Will you talk to them?
They don't want a martyr, Water Walker. Your death alone is not enough. It is how you die that is important.
She's only 6 years old.
There is nobody left for me to talk to. My oldest and dearest friends no longer hear me. You should have chosen your opponent with more care. As you are to the constables and the shopkeepers and merchants, so I am to my people. And I'm losing the battle. It's not just money you've cost me, it's my authority. And out of the two, that is going to prove deadly.
If she dies, I swear you will too.
You don't really think either of us will see tomorrow's dawn, do you?
Ival shook his head and raised a hand in farewell before going back into his study.
Ediard snarled in frustration and slammed his hand down on the rail.
You're the Water Walker, aren't you?
Huh? He turned round to see Christabel standing underneath a pergola entwined with a thick emerald vine. First impression, which he always felt dishonored by, was big wild hair and stick insect legs. Equally shaming was the accompanying thought. She's nothing like as pretty as Maxen made out. Christabel was tall, with a long thin face that, with her current mood, made her appear incredibly melancholic. A slender body was wrapped in a loose white cotton nightdress. Like her father, she'd been crying. Her hair, which was actually gold brown like her sister's, was threaded with lighter streaks. She'd been rubbing it or raking her hands through it, twining it into stringy strands which stuck out badly.